02-5526 Real 2.
Sam Marsh, Real 2. Can you describe a typical day at HMS Ganges?
Yes, a typical day. Reveille was blown on a trumpet, and it came over the loudhailer system in every billet, effectively. And at that, you had to get out of bed, whether you wanted to or not, and get dressed from your bedwear, pajamas, whatever, into whatever the dress of the day is listed as. And then all the beds get made up, and then they're all condensed back into a smaller area to leave space for tables and whatever for meals. And you had to convert the mess from a dormitory to a living quarters for daytime. You had about less than half an hour to get from your bed to being fully dressed and falling outside the mess, and that'd be 60 of you. But you were trying to have a quick wash and the teeth, and then grab some clothes, and then look for your shoes. And this is it's amusing because, as I said, at night all the beds are pulled down to open them up so that you're sleeping with gaps, as you should be. And you put your shoes under the bed, of course. And then when you slide all the beds back up to the top, usually you've got nothing else on but your bare feet. And then you're trying to find your shoes, and they're all down there somewhere, underneath somebody else's bed. That's a little spot of humour, and it did happen quite a lot. And as you're sliding your bed up, you fall over somebody else's shoes as well. And you think, bloody shoes. So it was a scramble, and you only had limited time to be out of bed, fold your blankets and all that back, be in the dress of the day, fully dressed, something like 20 minutes, maybe a little longer if you include a wash and a shave. Perhaps it might have been stretched to half an hour, but that was a maximum.
And what happened to you once you were assembled outside?
Well, they just check that you're all there. You know, you've got to answer your name as it's called out on a sheet, on a roster thing. And then you're back inside for breakfast. You're allowed, or it used to be in training in Ganges, I think it was half an hour to have your breakfast, put the proper kit of the day on, you know, which was your, like a naval uniform as opposed to a working rig, and have your breakfast and then fall in outside again. Then you were marched off up to the big parade ground, and at Ganges there was something like 3,000 boys there, and each mess contained about 64 boys, so you were all spread over this huge parade ground. Each mess had a chief petty officer in charge of it, and he would be there to, you know, you got to fall in where he says, and tension and all the rest of it. And then it's we had a morning prayer, and I'm trying to remember whether only on special occasions we had a verse of a hymn, maybe, but my memory won't recall that too clearly. And then you're already in a mess of people, say 60 people, and then you'd split apart into the two halves. There was always like an A class and a B class, a difference in, well, mental ability, really. And then you were marched off to either the gunnery school to do perhaps a couple of hours gunnery, or seamanship, which was in another building where you're learning all about sails on boats, navigation lights, all that sort of thing. And also, there was a dummy thing rigged up with a ship's wheel on it. This thing will operate with an electric motor in it, and it will jump the thing all over the place, you know. And you're there hanging onto this wheel, trying to steer it by the compass that's there. It's just to give you practice and training. That was one thing. Or it could be knots, splicing ropes, because there's an awful lot of that done when I joined up. I don't know what they do now, but some of it's got to go on.
What was the difference between the A class and the B class? What did the A class do?
Mental ability, really. It's alright, some go in the A, some go in the B. I was in the B, and then after about 10 weeks you get another check test, and if you're okay, you move up to the other side, you know, move up to the A. But it's very little difference, you're just in a different class. That was effectively what it was. Because if you've got 60 boys and one teacher, one instructor, that's an awful lot to for one instructor to contain, so they would split it in half, and like A and B, and you'd have two instructors. So. And the object was to bring the lower grade up to the same standard as the top grade.
Did you receive any ordinary schooling in addition to naval training?
Half the day was, like as I said, seamanship or gunnery, and the other half was school, and that was done in a different building. This was all done at HMS Ganges, Shotley Gate is a village near there, and it's right on the coast. I don't know whether it still goes now or not. I haven't got a clue.
What about the afternoons?
By and large, trying to think. We did have afternoon classes, but I think it depended on... Yes, I think everybody had afternoon classes. Although in the afternoon you had sport as well. And I think it was a different divisions of men, you know, it was about 120 odd in a division. It might have been their turn for the class, or their turn for the gunnery, or whatever, you know. But it was a full working day from, you can say, 7 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock afternoon, you know, or evening. And that was your... Sundays you had off. Very generous.
What did you do with that spare time?
Well, quite a lot. Used to collapse in a heap on her bed and fall asleep. Some read, some went playing football. You could go on a cross-country run if you wanted to. That was either a 3-mile one or a 7-mile one. And the chief petty officer would cycle along, round with you in front and behind. And it's amusing to say, but it's got to be said. The cross-country run effectively did that, round some fields. And he'd be behind you with his bike. And the ones that ride up in front, they found they could skyball through a gateway, and pick up the runners after they'd done three parts of it, and then just get in amongst them and trot back along with them. I think I did it about twice when I skived off. You know, everybody does it at some time, and some were doing it on a regular basis, you know. But and then the beauty of it was, if you'd done the run, you could then go straight into the swimming bath, lovely bath they had, for an hour, although it wasn't your turn to go in by, you know, each mess is allocated a time. And it meant, you know, that you could jump that queue if you'd done a cross-country run.
What about the mast at Shotley? Did you have to climb the mast at Shotley? Did you have to climb that?
Oh, yes. You're all meant to climb up the first lot of rigging, and that goes up between a huge safety net stretched all across. And then you go on the second lot of of rigging, which is not so wide and a fair bit longer, I think. And then there was you're on a platform then, you know, with a bit of a shielding around it. And then you had to go up the vertical bit, which is about 30 odd feet. Could have been more. I think the mast height total was about 100 and, I fancy it was about something like 180 feet high. It was enormous. And the last bit, you didn't have to do it, because obviously it takes nerve and you've got to be, some can do it, some can't. I never could, but you get your arms and legs round the post, and that's the top of the mast, and it's about something like that diameter. Polished smooth, where everybody's been sliding up and down, or a lot of them. And you start going up, and I did about a third of it, and then they freeze. If you can't, don't like heights, and all you can do, then you've got to come down. But if you're good, you can do it, and some could. You get to the top, and then there's what they call a button, and it's about that diameter of wood, but it's so thick. You've got a metal spike that comes up that you can catch hold of, and the idea of that is, well, you can do it at any time if you've got somebody to make sure you're all right. But when they have these a procedure known as dressing the mast, and everybody has to go on it at different stages, but you don't have to do the last bit. I did try to do the last bit, and I got about three or four movements up, and then I virtually froze. But you've got to forgive anybody, because 200 foot up is an awful lot. And although you've got the nets all down there, you've got the huge big booms of a mast like you'd have on a ship. And if you fell, your chances are you might not miss these booms and land on the net. You might finish up, you know, killing yourself on the booms, because they're steel and they're huge and they're heavy. And but they try and get your nerves up to a certain standard. That's what it was all about.
How much did you get paid?
In actual pay, we had a payday once a week, I think. Or was it once a month in the beginning? We had half a crown pay, but the rest of the money, I think it was perhaps nearer to being, may have been 10 shillings or more, was put into your savings compulsory. You were shown the book, and you signed it, you know, that you agreed it had gone in. But that's as near as you got to your money. But you had half a crown to spend in the naffy if you wanted to. And if you go in there and have a couple of pints of lemonade, because it was very hot, it was summer, and it was, as I said, HMS Gander at Shotley, very hot up there in summer. And you could blew it all on a couple of drinks and on those Eccles cakes. One Eccles cake and two pints of lemonade. That was all your money gone for a week. Oh, yeah. But certainly learned the value of money.
How did you keep in contact with people? How did you keep in contact with people at home? And what was the reaction of your family to you joining the Navy?
Well, my family, I lost two brothers in the war. Stepbrother at home, he was killed in Italy, and the next brother down, Fred, he was killed in Burma during the war. So how did we keep in touch with home?
Was your family's reaction to joining the Navy, and how did you keep in contact with them?
Well, by letter I used to write home to Mum and Dad, because they were the only two home, you know. I was the youngest and I'd left. And my sisters had left, obviously, home. They were working away and lodging in Taunton and whatever, that sort of thing.
What was their reaction to you joining the Navy?
Sorry, that was a question, wasn't it? dubious. First of all, Mum wasn't going to sign the paper for me to go, having lost two boys, you know, in the war. And this was in 1946. I joined up with him. Yeah, sure, it was 46. She wasn't very keen at all, but she wouldn't stand in my way, you know, because she knew that, all right, I had like a personal vendetta in my mind. You know, they killed my two brothers. I'm joining up. I want to get my own back. And so there wasn't any argument, really. I knew why I wanted to go.
How long were you at HMS Ganges for?
A year. The shortest you could be there was about a year, or 12, 13 months. If you did the telecoms course, which was a lot more involved and a higher educational level, so you'd be there 70 odd weeks, but with leave periods and everything. That was nearly 2 years you were there. And the seamanship one that I wanted to go in, that I did go in, that was about a year. You know, taking in the leave periods and everything.
What happened to you after you left?
Ganges. By train down to Plymouth. Because you're all allocated, or you apply to be allocated to the nearest one to your home, and Plymouth was nearest to me, west of England. We had some educational lessons, and this is why you're waiting to go on draft. You can be waiting perhaps up to 3 or 4 months, and then you're suddenly drafted, you know, to a ship abroad, usually abroad. And we went over by troop ship. I'm trying to think where we got the troop ship from. But anyway, I joined HMS Norfolk in the East Indies station, as it's known as, you know, the position graphically where it is. I was on her. I drafted on with about 60 other boys, and then she was due to come home, the ship itself. But if you'd only been drafted out like we had, say a year before, you weren't allowed to come home then with the ship. You had to go on draft further on, and that's what happened.
So you were aboard HMS Norfolk for a year?
Yes.
Can you tell me what happened when you arrived? What were your first impressions?
Well, on board the ship?
Yes.
We arrived on her in the evening. We were falling on the upper deck, marched down to a mess, and given a whopping great open of chips and fish, as if he hadn't eaten for a week. And it was marvellous, you know, in boys' training, that we'd never seen such meals as big or so well cooked or anything. And that was our first intuition into a big ship, was a meal.
How did you adjust to living on a big ship like that?
Well, where you've been used to being on land and in a billet, and you're grouped as a mess, that automatically follows on with you, the same sort of operation, the same system. You've got your own mess. I think there were 60 of us boy seamen went on to HMS Norfolk. And she was already around East India Station. I'm trying to think where she was when we joined her, but I can't. Not now. I haven't gone back through this for years. it was wonderful to get on board ship, because in your mind, this is what I joined for. At last I've made it. I'm at sea. I've got a ship and call my own. I've got an action station position. I've got a duty watch to keep. And you're in with all the system of being a proper naval man, if you like.
What was your ordinary job and what was your action station?
Well, I was still in a boys. I was still in a boys seamen group. Let's see. We were allocated a workstation on board ship, and mine was on the forecastle, which is the forward end of the ship. Consists of scrubbing decks and polishing brasswork and all things like that, cleaning out the motorboat, or the called the pinnace, as it was called. General cleaning operations, but that was half your day. And as we were boy seamen, the other half was actual lessons on gunnery, down on the guns, or the 4-inch guns or 8-inch guns, the 8-inch on the Norfolk. And 8-inch? Yeah, I'm sure they were 8-inch. scrubbing decks, polishing brasswork. Being a crew member of a rowing boat, and also on the one I got onto, which I wanted to be on, was the motorboat. Well, there's a motorboat and a thing called a pinnace, and then a rowing boat stage, you know, that functioned to the nearest shoreline when you're in harbour. That's the basis of the boat's crews. And it was a good insight, you know, into a bit of naval work, but you do a lot of boat scrubbing and brass cleaning and everything to do with the boat. And to get down to it, you're going on a boom, about a 30-foot long boom, and you're about 30 foot off the waterline, and a cruiser holding this rope thing, and then you go down a scrambling net, I think we had at one time, and the other time you slide down the rope and you hope that you're going to go straight into the boat and then they're waiting for you. Sounds simple to say it now, but it was quite nervy at the time, looking down 30 foot down and down a rope, you know, or a ladder, part of it, Jacob's ladder and part rope. Sorry, I've interrupted you.
No, carry on.
But so that was the seamanship side. But then there was also the gunnery side you get, and it's usually alternated, 1 week seamanship, 1 week gunnery, and that takes up half a day of each of them. And then you do schoolwork, maths and everything as a boys' service that fills in the day.
As a boy seaman, did you have to work to a watch system?
Not exactly the same, no. We did have, usually it was a cleaning operation that we were put on. Scrub out this, scrub out the sick bay, scrub something else. Until we went abroad, and then we were on the doing the duty watch morning and evening, but not through the night. We were considered, you know, boy seamen are too young. You know, it's you don't go through the night.
What about your action station?
Allocated to whatever it might be. I know when I was abroad and I was on the Amethyst, I was on a 4-inch gun crew.
What about the Norfolk?
X and Y, X gun crew.
What about the Norfolk? Before we
the
come
Norfolk,
to Amethyst.
That was 8-inch, let me think. Well, it could vary, but one of them was in the wheelhouse, and you take a turn on the trips wheel, and all right, you've got the coxswain behind you, two or three other members of the crew, which were, you know, normally do this, but to give each boy seaman a chance to know what it's about, the chief sends one boy up, or perhaps two, each evening watch, you know, which is from 6 o'clock till 8 o'clock in the evening. And you'll be up there watching the coxswain himself doing it, you know. And the thing, the most difficult thing about it, or you appreciate a compass, and it's marked all the way around in degrees. But with a modern ship, you've got a strip, and you see these numbers come up, and there's a center point which represents your ship that you're on, and then you get these numbers, and as you turn the wheel a little bit, it go click, 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 and it's counting degrees, like 40, 42, 44, something after that system. But although every single degree, it counts every single one. And then you're told, you take the wheel, and you have to report down the voice pipe, which goes straight up to the bridge, which is above you. Boy Seaman Marsh on the wheel, sir. Or Boy Seaman Marsh to take the wheel, sir. And then you'll contact down to the the coxswain who's actually doing it all, put Boy Seaman Marsh on the thing, and you get accustomed to doing it. And in the end, actually, everything you do on board like that as boys, you don't realise it all gets logged. And when I came back eventually into Drake Barracks, I'd wanted to. Radar plot was what I wanted to do. This was modern electronics, and I knew it would be better than the other old stuff. And this commander looked up, you know, because he's sitting there, and you sat in front of him. I said, "Oh, Marsh, you know, whatever it was." And he said, "You're down as coxswain. You want to be a coxswain?" I said, "No, I really wanted to be radar plot." So, No, he said, "I've got you down here as coxswain." And, there's nothing you can do about it. All right, it proved one point. There was me and a kiddie called Jock Morrison, and every evening watch, you fall in for 2 hours' work. But if you're detailed to go to the wheelhouse, you don't do any scrubbing or anything like that. You're actually taken over the ship for a little while. 10 minutes at a time, perhaps 3 or 4 goes during your 2 hours that you're there. And we quickly found out, you know, that you can get out of the scrubbing if you push yourself and go on the wheel. But a lot of the boys, you know, you're about 60 of you on board a ship, a boy seaman that is. They were frightened, they didn't want to touch it. "Oh, I couldn't do that. I'd do nothing else if I had the chance." Anyway, that's probably deviating from your.
What was the chain of command for boy seaman? Who was immediately in charge of you, and who did you take your orders from?
We had a chief petty officer allocated to the mess. We had two allocated to the mess. And they would be taking in turn, you know. We had to fall in every evening and do this, work a watch system. But the chiefs used to take it in turns, you know, sort of every other evening they'd be up there with us. And you could get any duty. It could be scrubbing a chunk of deck, polishing brass, the ship's wheel if you were all right. So me and a guy called Jock Morrison, we were lucky. But I found out quite a few years later, Jock died. He was dead a long ago. He was a great character. But there, you know, things change in life, don't they? Nothing is the same forever.